lights have been on.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the December 13th, 2016 Senate Committee on Interim Committee on Business and Transportation, our last meeting of the year, last meeting of this legislature, actually. Okay, so we've got three reports up, and then we'll do the introduction of legislative bills. So we'll start off first with the Retirement Savings Board, and welcome Mr. Treasurer and Lisa, Joel.
Thank you.
I will remind the committee, as they're getting seated here, that this is one of our pieces of legislation that we passed actually twice. We did it in 15. We did the task report, which the treasurer task force to do the feasibility. The treasurer chaired that, and then last session we passed this one to set up the fund. When we did it, we thought we would be a late comer to the process, but as it turns out, we'll probably be the first state that actually launches a plan. But there are 27 or 28 others that are doing it in the same process, both red and blue states, so I'll note looking at this. I've been the Senate designee to the board ex officio member on it, and we were fortunate that Treasurer Wheeler was able to convince Lisa Messina to come and be the, I don't ever know what your title is, executive director. Lisa has, I would just embarrass her a little, she has just this incredible resume in the investment community, and I think left a lot of money on the table to come back and do public service for the state of Oregon, and has just done a phenomenal job getting us moving in the right direction. So we're very, very fortunate to have Lisa with us. And with that, I'm going to stop talking, and I'll turn it over to the treasurer.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. And for at least the next 2 weeks or so, I get to be state treasurer. I'm also here, as the senator said, in my capacity as the chair of the Oregon Retirement Savings Board. We have a number of really top-flight citizens who stepped forward to serve with us, Kara Backus, Kevin Jensen, Juanita Santana, Corey Streisinger. Of course, Senator Beyer is key to this committee, as well as State Representative Reed, and I want to thank all of them for their service. We're doing painstaking work to make sure that we get this right for everybody, from workers to employers to payroll specialists, and I'm very pleased so far with the results, and we're going to update you on those results today. As Senator Beyer mentioned, I'm joined here today by Director Lisa Messina and Joel Metlin from the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan. First, a protocol is in place. I want to thank you, and I want to thank your colleagues in the legislature for having passed the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan in 2015. And as Chair Beyer had mentioned, this was on the heels of a task force, which I had the privilege to be associated with prior to that. It addresses a very significant need. And I want to just lay the foundation before these two get into the formal update on the proposal. And I think it's important to give you some of this context in terms of the need. The retirement savings gap in the United States, the difference between what people have actually saved versus what they should have saved for their retirement, is now measured in the trillions of dollars. By some estimates, it's about 14 times larger than the outstanding student financial debt situation. People ask me all the time, well, you know, how much should somebody have saved for retirement? There's lots of different formulas out there, but they all get you to basically the same place. One very common formula that's used by professionals is that for your retirement, you should have something in the neighborhood of 8 times your current wages saved up or squirreled away somewhere. So if you're making about $50,000 a year, you should have something in the neighborhood of about $400,000 saved exclusively for your retirement. So how are we doing? We're not doing very well. Here in the state of Oregon, average household savings are about $3,000. As a benchmark, people say retirement now lasts 20 years, sometimes 30 years for some people because of better nutrition, better health outcomes. But that $3,000 average household savings, that'll buy you a month and a half of rent in Portland. The national statistics aren't much better. According to the U.S. Federal Reserve, the mean household savings for retirement is about $2,000. Statistically, given the purpose, that's effectively zero. So against that backdrop, there are three core facts I want you to know about this retirement savings program. There's lots of data, lots of facts. We could bury you. We're not going to do it. There's three facts I want you to remember. The first fact is this. Fact number one, people are 15 times more likely to save for their retirement, and they will save more if they have access to a retirement program through their place of employment. 15 times more likely to save. Fact number two, nearly half of Oregon's workforce, or over 1 million people, do not have access to a retirement savings program through their place of employment. Over 1 million people. Amongst those 1 million, women, people of color, people who have a high school diploma or less education are disproportionately overrepresented amongst the ranks of people who do not have access to a retirement program through their place of employment. Fact number three, if we do not address this retirement savings crisis in the state of Oregon, it will crush us financially. It will impact families. It will impact communities. If we cannot find ways for people to voluntarily save their own resources for their own retirement, the cost to taxpayers in the state of Oregon will be staggering as more and more people rely instead on costly government safety net services. This is a trend that is already well underway. This means that dollars that could go towards education or public health or public safety are instead going to be crowded out and used to help backstop people who were not able or chose not to or did not for any reason save for their own retirement. It's going to pit the investment needs of a younger generation against the retirement needs of older adults. So I'm sure you agree that is not a good outcome. So it brings us to the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan that we've been working on. We believe it's a smart, measured solution that addresses all three of those facts. It will be targeted only to those who don't have other options at work. It will create a new generation of savers, and every dollar that people save, that's less pressure on taxpayers down the road. And at the same time, as mandated by the legislation, it does not create any fiduciary risk for employers in the state of Oregon. That is mandated by the legislation, and this plan does that. One quick clarification, because there was some confusion about this during the last legislative session. This is not PERS. This is not related or connected in any way to PERS. This is not a pension. This is a vehicle that enables people to save their own resources through their for their own retirement through their own individual investment account. What it does is it breaks down the barriers that we have identified that make it difficult for people to save for their own retirement. We've been working very hard for the last 18 months. Senator Beyer, you've been part of this effort from the very get-go. We've been meeting with employers, large and small. We've been meeting with workers. We've been meeting with processors, payroll specialists, retirement planning specialists, experts from all around the country who have come here to help us shape this plan. And the bottom line is this. The plan is financially and legally feasible. The goals are to make sure that people who want to save at work have the option to do so. And the second broad principle is keep it simple. We're trying to keep it simple for employers so that they have a minimum of hassle factor, a minimum of paperwork. All they have to do is do another withholding the same way they do the withholding currently for payroll taxes. And again, there are no fees. There is no fiduciary risk to employers. For workers, we also want to keep it simple. We want simple investment options, and that's something the board is currently discussing. And we want the user interface to be simple and straightforward as well, because all of us acknowledge on the Retirement Savings Board that if it's too complicated, people will probably opt out, as is their right to do under the terms of this plan. We submitted a full report to you on December 1st. It gives you soup to nuts. The report was approved unanimously by the Retirement Savings Board. In conclusion, I want to say this, and you certainly stated this, Chair Beyer, up front, but I think it warrants mentioning again. In Oregon, we are always very proud of our firsts, whether it was the bottle bill, whether it was the beach bill, whether it was the motor voter bill. I am very happy, actually, with the fact that the rest of the nation is now looking to Oregon. We will be the first state to roll out a state-sponsored retirement savings program, assuming that we roll out as scheduled on July 1st. And I want to thank you again for your leadership and your support and all the work you've put into making this a reality. I'll now turn this over to Lisa and Joel, but I'll stay here in case there's questions.
Thank you, Treasurer Wheeler. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, it's my pleasure to speak with you today. For the record, I'm Lisa Messina. I'm the director of the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan. And as noted by the Treasurer, HB 2960 paved the way for a simple, voluntary, work-based retirement plan for Oregonians lacking access to a savings option through their place of work. The plan's use of best practices will make it easy for Oregonians to participate and to save. And those best practices include things like automatic enrollment. If you've ever had to look for a form for something, automatic enrollment is a good thing. Contributions through payroll deduction. The assets will be professionally managed, and they'll be portable in a concept we call one account for life. But whether you work for one employer or multiple at the same time or over time, your assets will be saved in a single account for you. So here's something else to remember. Because of the plan, in a few years' time, Oregon's workers will have accumulated billions of dollars toward their retirement that they wouldn't otherwise have saved. So a couple of other things. Today's report was required under the legislation, but it also gives us an opportunity to work with you together. We're starting a major publicity push for the plan, and as you know, the budget wasn't a huge budget. It was a pretty, I'm going to say, efficient budget. And so opportunities like this help us spread the word to get Oregonians excited about the plan. So thank you for doing that with us. We also want all Oregonians to know that we're actively soliciting input into the rulemaking process. We have a public hearing set for this Thursday, and written comments are requested by December 23. So more information is available on our website, oregon.gov/retire. So with your permission, we'd like to cover the background information. We're going to cover it quickly, as much of it is familiar. I've had a chance to meet with a number of you. Much of it is familiar, but if we're going too quickly, please stop us at any point with questions you have. So we'll start with a little bit of good news. We're living longer. We think that's a great thing. We're not saving very much. We think that's a significant challenge, particularly here in Oregon. So a healthy 65-year-old, as we're talking about, is looking at 20 years or more in retirement. We also talked about the fact that Oregon is likely to be the first state-sponsored plan to go live. That wasn't our first aim, but we are sitting underneath the Golden Pioneer, and I think it's very appropriate. Around the country, people are watching carefully what is happening here. I think there's some pride at being first. It's big and important. In this big and important initiative, but it also comes with a bright spotlight, so we're working to get it right. The Aspen Institute came to Oregon earlier this year to help us present an Oregon Savings Summit. The summit highlighted that plans like these are going to be critical to blunt a wave of poverty in retirement, and there are other benefits as well. So we've been having roundtables with employers around the state. They uniformly say they want to help their employees be more financially secure. And research also shows that when employees have less financial stress, their job performance, attendance, and job satisfaction all improve. So what is it? The board has opted to go with a Roth IRA as the model account, and there are a few advantages of a Roth IRA. So one of them is assets are contributed after tax. Because of that, they're in the account after tax and they're in the account on a tax-protected basis, and again, can be accessed without any penalty. So savings can be accessed in an emergency, which we think is an important feature of the plan, but there are no taxes in retirement. And as you can see in this particular view, the program combines the best features and practices of both IRAs and 401k plans in a very simple way. Some of the other information that we've developed in earlier research, it's amazing to think about it, but as we mentioned, 1 million Oregonians don't have the ability to save at work. So this is the breakdown from some of the research that was conducted for the plan earlier this year. As we talked about, workers without plans, access to plans, often share one or more common characteristics. They tend to be younger. They tend to earn less. They may be working, are more likely to be working part-time. They have fewer years of formal education. They're more likely to be non-white. They're more likely to work for a small company. And they're more likely to work in the service and hospitality sectors. But all sectors are represented by folks who don't have plans. So let's talk a little bit about employers, because employers are a really critical component of this particular activity. We've been working closely with employers since actually before I came on board, and during my tenure we've continued that activity. A number of ways that we're doing that: we held a variety of public meetings focused on specific topics earlier this year, and in addition to that, we're currently holding roundtables around the state and taking a wide variety, sometimes as many as a dozen inquiries every day. We're also working with partner agencies to help us spread the word. So we found that a lot of employers in Oregon offer plans to their employees, but as we can see here, more of them don't. About two-thirds of our employers do not. And a large number of those employers, about 80%, have fewer than 10 employees. So a large number of small employers with employees that don't have access. On the other side of the coin, about half of the employees in the group that I just showed you work for a larger employer, so employer with more than 100 employees. So what that brings home for us is it is important for the program to be accessible and easy to use, both for small employers who will be affected in large numbers and for large employers who employ the majority or a majority of the affected employees. The treasurer's requirement is that this be a simple plan as well. Here's a little bit of information on how it will work. For employers, there will be a minimal cost associated with entry into and facilitation of the plan. Facilitation of the plan includes elements like introducing the plan to employees, providing the data to automatically enroll employees in the plan, processing and remitting payroll deductions, and collecting and saving opt-out decisions. As much as it's been within our ability, we've worked to develop a design that doesn't call for anything more from employers than that. Very simple, very streamlined. Last week as well, the board approved a company as a plan manager for this program, so we're completing our due diligence. That company will manage the interface for customers, so savers, run the helpline, et cetera. So that will not be the responsibility of employers. Based on the draft plan, here's a division of what some of the responsibilities employers are and what employees will do. And again, we've placed a high priority on keeping it as simple as possible and keeping employer requirements to a minimum. From an employee standpoint, you'll see you don't need to do anything to enroll and start saving, but you do have some choices. You can decide to save more or less. You can decide to choose a different type of an investment option, or of course, you can decide not to be in the plan at all. So we talked a little bit about the financial feasibility and the legality of the plan. So the plan is feasible both based on time to become cash positive and time needed for the program to become net positive, which is to repay its startup costs. As you may recall, the plan is required to be self-sustaining. And so we took a good look at a wide variety of different positive and negative circumstances to confirm that it would, in fact, be self-sustaining. So the plan is forecast to become cash flow positive in 4 to 5 years and net positive in 7 to 8 years. So this assumes a phased rollout, average contribution starting at 5%, annual fees at 1 to 1.2% on asset balances, and those fees are expected to decline over time. By offering the plan service provider a longer-term contract, one of the things that we've been able to do as well is to retain a provider who will essentially invest on our behalf with the expectation that they'll be paid and break even out of surpluses of the plan over time. So the new DOL safe harbor option also allows the plan to be considered a non-ERISA plan. So that means we can help employees save while not imposing any sort of fiduciary risk on employers, which is a win-win for them. We also kept in mind the bill was written with the 1975 safe harbor in mind, so that is a support for the program as well. So with that in mind, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Joel Metlin to talk a little bit about some of the engagement work that we're currently doing with employees, employers, and their representatives.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee for having us here. For the record, my name is Joel Metlin, and I work for Oregon State Treasury helping start up the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan. What we're doing right now, in addition to all the work behind the scenes, is really reaching out to as many folks as we can, that's employers, employees, and other stakeholders, to try to get them engaged in the process so that we can listen to them, hear what they have to say, know what they need to know as we're developing the plan and then preparing for implementation. And this is especially important right now as we're in the rulemaking process. We're deciding, some of the basic functions of the plan and how it'll work. And we need to know that it'll work for them and that it really does meet the goals of being simple and lowering as many barriers as possible to get people saving. So we're going to use all of that information that we're collecting now. And we're going to help us develop the plan and also help identify some folks who can stay with us and continue to give us input as we move towards our implementation starting in July. And in July, it isn't a full rollout. It's really just a pilot. We're going to get a small number of employers who can help us make sure that everything's working, adjust what needs to be done, so that as we start to roll it out to more employers, that we continually improve it and make sure that it works for everyone in the different types of industries, situations that people are in. So the actual rollout after the pilot will probably be in early 2018, and we're going to again do it then in phases so that we aren't trying to enroll thousands of businesses and tens of thousands of Oregonians all at once. We want to make sure that we're doing this right and that we work out all of the issues as we go. So we're trying to be deliberate about it. We know that this is a big ask and is an important program, and we want to do it right the first time. As we're rolling this out, it's also going to give us an interesting opportunity to engage Oregonians about personal finance. And one of the things that the legislature requested that we do as we consider the development of this program is to come back to you with a series of financial literacy improvement recommendations. How can the state improve what it does and working with its partners to give access, better access to Oregonians to the tools and resources out there to help them take control of their own financial futures? And so we collected a lot of different stakeholders, brought them into a working group, talked about what everybody's doing out there and how we could better work together and what might we do in the future to improve what we're doing. And we came up with a series of recommendations. Basically, what we found is that there's a lot of good work going on out there. It's just not as connected and integrated as it possibly could be to have the maximum effect. So our goal as the plan really is to try to use this touch point to connect with Oregonians, give them access to other resources, and at the same time start be involved in the larger conversation that's going on about how we can all work together going forward. And what we'd really ask of you is that you help support us and the other agencies and nonprofits and other partners in this field as we move forward and try to make this a better connected and better network for folks here in Oregon. because we're all trying to serve the ultimate goal, which is people achieving financial security. And retirement savings is one part of that, an important part, and we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to coordinate with everyone else in this space. So with that, that's the end of our presentation. We're very happy that you asked us to be here, and we welcome any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator?
The concern I have is basically the liability to the state should investments go south. When PERS went upside down, when the market crashed, we lost 40%, and we have never recovered from that to this day. We're probably, if you use proper accounting, we're $40 billion in the hole. So my question is, what are you doing to protect the state from any liability should there be a crash in the market or a crash in these investments from the investor?
Well, I'll handle that. I'm not an attorney, but these are individual retirement accounts. So the relationship here isn't with the state, although we are fiduciaries because we are the sponsor. There is no guarantee of performance, and there is no guarantee of investment return. And unless we do something that is deliberately detrimental to those accounts, we have no liability for performance whatsoever. So I want to state this again. This is not like PERS, where PERS is a contingent liability to the state. This is a completely separate one-off. This is more like the 529 college savings plan.
I would add that it's intentionally designed. Not $1 of investor employee money will ever touch the state's hands.
Oh, well, that's a good thing. Otherwise, we'd spend it.
It goes, I mean, that's it. The savings board's is to select an operator or manager to do it, and we've been fortunate in terms we've had some of the biggest providers of services in the nation. That was a concern we had. Come in, and they're there. They see this. When it's been interesting to have the national folks attend every one of the board meetings as participants. They all see this as the next step forward for the nation, that we need to do this. And as the treasurer said, starting out, if we don't do this, if you look down the road 15, 20, 30 years, we're in a pack of trouble. Well, we won't be. We probably won't be around anymore. But our kids and our grandkids will have a big problem.
I'm still just concerned about the state's liability issue, and I will be until I see reasons not to be. And just because we say that we set it up so that we're not liable, you can't say, I'm not liable. That doesn't work. I mean, you can put it in all the forms, but there comes a point with good trial attorneys, and God knows we've given the trial attorneys every way to sue you right, left, and center, that liability becomes an issue. So that's the concern that personally that I have. I think it's a good idea if that issue can be resolved. But again, with what happened with PERS, and the state's never recovered from that.
Right. Well, let me add just one more piece of color commentary to this. And I don't actually know if this is in the report because it may be too recent of a development, if I may, Chair Beyer. We're currently in negotiations with the U.S. Treasury that has the MIRA platform as a potential capital preservation option within the plan. So people will, if people are completely risk averse, they will actually have an option in this plan to move their assets to a complete capital preservation strategy. So we're giving people maximum flexibility to be able to respect their own tolerance for risk.
Other questions?
Yes.
Senator.
Yeah. Ted, you're going to be transitioning to another rather important job in a few weeks. Have you talked to your successor in the treasurer's office, Mr. Reed, about this program, and is he on board so that there would be a seamless kind of transition when you leave office?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, members of the committee, Tobias Reed is very well informed on this plan. He, in fact, was the carrier of the retirement savings plan bill in the House. He currently sits with Chair Beyer on the committee as the representative from the House side. He's very well versed on this plan and is very supportive of it, obviously, and is as motivated as I am to see it through correctly.
That's very important to me, that there be a smooth transition, because it's it, just as this is kind of coming off the draft stage and going into the implementation stage, at the same time we're changing state treasurers. If that were not the case, I'd be troubled.
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, members of the committee, if I may just add to that answer, I don't believe my job as treasurer is completed until I am confident that we've had a successful and thoughtful transition. So for many weeks since the election, we've actually been working on a seamless transition strategy, not only for the retirement savings program, but for the whole suite of Treasury operations. And I feel very confident about the way the transition is going.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Just a quick question. We met in my room yesterday, so could you go over the, like, a typical, like, during harvest time, I'll have 40 employees, and I have to make, do I have to make 40 individual entries or shift that money 40 separate times? Like a FICA deposit, I make one deposit every time I make a payroll.
Right.
So if you have 40 different people making four, these aren't salaried employees, everybody works different hours. Everybody's paycheck is different. Everybody's paycheck is different. Do I have to, as an employer, sit there and make 40 entries each time I do a payroll for that? I don't see how that works. I can't just send, like FICA, you click a button and you send $2,000 to the bank, the federal government on the FICA system. How will this work?
So if I may comment, we're still working on the plan design. We are involving employers and folks who work on payroll and payroll software to make sure that it's as efficiently designed as possible. But the concept is that an employer will make one contribution per payroll period across all of their contributing employees. So intended to be very simple.
Well,
it would be the same. It would be the same as payroll tax or any other thing that is contributed on a consolidated basis.
So, I can see that that's not possible. If everybody, if the total amount was $100 and there's 60 employees, then you just divide that evenly, no matter if they earn different amounts of money.
So there is information that needs to come along with that that will say how much is attributed to each employee. So
the employer's going to have to tell them how many each individual made. So will there be an administrative fee for employers that have to pay some? I do that myself, but if they have bookkeepers and they're that kind of stuff, will there be an administrative fee attached to these for that employer cost?
So I think it's a terrific question. We've been talking with payroll and the administrative community, and the responses we're getting, it's that this is no big deal. Now, I'm using their words, right? So the responses they're giving us is this is no big deal. This is like any other deduction. We don't see it as being complicated. So it is our mission and our duty to make sure that as we prepare to launch the program, we have done a good job of informing everyone who's involved, giving them an opportunity to continue weighing in. So these processes are very simple and very streamlined.
Remains to be seen. Thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, next up, we're going to have a report back on the solar initiative. This is a bill that we passed last time and demanded they come back. And I think we're going to start out with the good chair of the PUC.
I'm stealing.
Welcome, Chair Hardy.
Good morning.
And then you come up and say, Chair, I need $50 out of everybody to retire. I'm going to talk to my employees.
morning, Chair Beyer.
Good morning.
Of the committee. My name is Lisa Hardy. I'm the chair of the Public Utility Commission of Oregon. And I've been invited to give a short summary of the PUC solar incentives report that we sent over to you guys at the end of October. So House Bill 2941 was passed in 2015, and it directed the PUC to evaluate Oregon's solar PV incentive programs and to recommend whether the incentive should be discontinued, continued without change, or continued with modifications. It also directed the PUC to recommend the most effective, efficient, and equitable approach to incenting the development and use of solar PV systems in Oregon. We had a lot of stakeholder interest in this report. So in addition to the staff analysis, the PUC provided some public process to provide opportunities for public input. Overall, we held two staff workshops. We circulated three drafts with opportunity for written comment. And we had two public meetings with the commissioners to allow for oral comment on the report, and ultimately submitted that report to you on October 28th of this year. So as part of its review, the PUC first identified a number of programs available in Oregon that incentivize or potentially incentivize solar development, and you see that list here. Some of these programs were designed not only to incentivize solar, but also other renewables or sometimes energy efficiency as well. In our review of programs, we did not offer specific recommendations on certain programs that were adopted, revised, or eliminated by the 2016 Oregon legislature. So, these include, for example, the new RPS standard, which we are in the process of implementing, the solar capacity standard, which was eliminated, the community solar program, which is a new program that was adopted as part of Senate Bill 1547, which we have an open docket, and we're in the process of shaping that program. So some of the 2016 work either eliminated programs or created new programs that don't have a track record yet for evaluation. Second, after House Bill 2941 was passed, the Oregon Department of Energy was tasked with conducting a programmatic review of each of its ODO-administered incentive programs. So in light of this programmatic review of ODO's programs, including tax credits and the loan programs that they implement, the commission didn't make any specific recommendations on the specific design of these taxpayer-funded incentives for solar PV installations, but instead made some more generalized recommendations about taxpayer versus ratepayer-funded incentive programs. So when evaluating the incentives for and development of solar PV, the industry is obviously changing. And so one critical element of piece of context for sort of any sort of evaluation is the growth in the solar industry and the reduction in costs that we are seeing. You'll see on this first bullet here from 2009 to 2015, the average cost of solar PV installations fell from about $7.50 per watt to about $2.50 per watt.
Lisa, is that based on residential installations, or does that include utility or large-scale installations?
That includes large scale as well. I think for 2015, if we are just carving out residential installations, we're looking at about $4 rather than the $2.50 there. So this is sort of all solar PV.
What does hydro run per watt?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that per watt. I think it would depend on the facility.
But we're continuing. Depends on the old ones or new ones.
Well, I mean, if you're given a blank for solar, it's gonna.
If you were trying to build Grand Coulee again today, I think the number would be a lot larger. Your environmental impact study would probably take more than that. I'm sorry.
A little banter going on up there.
But what we are seeing as these costs are declining And as these incentives are put in place, is a lot of growth in solar energy generation. Since about 2008, we've seen very rapid growth in the industry. In 2009, I think there were about 1,000 solar PV installations in the state, and as of 2015, that was closer to 10,000 and growing. So that number is definitely going up. PGE estimates that 125 to 223 megawatts of distributed solar will be developed in its service territory by 2035. PacifiCorp projects that it will have 232 to 568 megawatts of distributed solar in its service territory over that same time period. So we're seeing costs going down. We're seeing the industry grow. Another piece of context for the recommendations or just sort of a review of the solar industry at large is Senate Bill 1547, which was passed earlier this year. It changed the energy landscape quite a bit in terms of sort of how we're looking at these things. Obviously, it increased the RPS to 50% by 2040 for investor-owned utilities, PGE and PacifiCorp. It eliminated the solar capacity standard, created the community solar program, and mandated some small-scale community-based renewables. So for a number of these, we have yet to see how that affects the development of solar PV. Finally, another a piece of context that I would just call out is something that it has always been an issue with sort of evaluating incentives, which is the interactive effects of existing incentives. For the most part, we find that the state's incentives can be used in conjunction with one another and typically are. Customers combine these incentives in various ways to sort of bring down their out-of-pocket costs for solar PV installation. And this creates an overlapping effect, which makes it difficult to determine the impact that individual programs have on the development of solar. And this is something I'll speak about a little more later. Legislative factors. So House Bill 2941 directed the PUC to consider a number of factors in making the recommendations. Those are listed here. I'd call out just a couple of them. One is the resource value of solar energy. This is, I think, becoming a metric that is going to be an important one, at least for the PUC. The resource value of solar is defined as the value that solar generation brings to a utility system and to all ratepayers. So this is a quantifiable metric that we are working on that includes things like avoided energy costs, avoided capacity additions, avoided transmission and distribution investments. The commission is currently has an open docket to develop the resource value of solar, or RVOS. We are in the first phase of that rather complex undertaking to figure out first a methodology for determining RVOS, and then second to calculate specific values for different utilities. And that's a metric that I think will be important for evaluating solar from at least the PUC's rate making perspective for some time.
Are you looking at what other states have already done on that?
We are. We are. Yes. And in fact, we're also hired E3 as a consultant to help with that. They've got experience in doing this across the nation as well. So we're trying to take advantage of, because as you know, it's such a complex undertaking. We're definitely taking the best of the things in other states where we can. The second factor is, I think, the third bullet here. I would note the costs borne by persons who do not participate in solar PV programs. This is another metric that the commission is, again, it's difficult to calculate. We're trying to keep our eye on the ball and make sure that we understand how cost shifting might work between participating and non-participating customers. So this would apply only to ratepayer funded incentives, not to larger taxpayer funded programs. But cost shifting happens when one customer is over or under compensated for the value of their solar PV system. So for example, if you're a PGE customer and you put solar PV on your roof, if you are being overcompensated for the value of that generation, then the other customers in PGE system will be subsidizing you. If you are being underpaid for the value, you are subsidizing the rest of the system and vice versa. And so that's a metric you want to make sure that we keep our eye on, and as the systems get more complex and more solar PV comes on. Application of the factors. One, in considering Looking at the incentives, the PUC categorized incentives as either ratepayer funded, I think you've heard me mention that a couple times, or taxpayer funded incentives. We see a little bit of a different use for each of them. In general, the PUC concluded that when incentives are funded by ratepayers of a specific utility, that the solar facility should be treated as a system resource, and the ratepayers should pay no more than the value of the solar PV generation to that utility system. And this approach is what we are trying to target to prevent inappropriate cost shifting. Incentives that don't really fall into this kind of a quantitative metric or that are generally outside the PUC's normal purview, something like improved air quality for all Oregonians, for example, which is not susceptible to the same kind of utility system metric, we think are most logically funded by society or taxpayers as a whole through some of the more broad taxpayer-funded programs. So this is a chart that I think just demonstrates why it is so difficult, nearly impossible, actually, to isolate a single incentive program and analyze how that particular incentive incentivizes the development of solar PV. That top line there is the cost of a solar PV system. We could use any number of examples. This is a residential customer of an investor-owned utility. You see the cost of that solar going down over time. But this particular customer, hypothetically, as an example, stacks up a number of different incentives to bring down the cost of a solar PV system. This slide shows a residential customer using a federal solar investment tax credit, the state residential energy tax credit, an energy trust incentive, and this customer is also enrolled as a net metering customer of their utility. So you can see that if a customer takes advantage of all these incentives bundled together, it really brings down the out-of-pocket costs for a customer who wants to install solar PV on their rooftop. So the first recommendation that the PUC provided is that if the legislature wants to capture the full social and economic benefits of solar PV, it should adopt taxpayer-funded incentive programs. And we note that allocating the costs of promoting solar through the tax base will ensure that the wider social benefits, for example, I mentioned air quality or sort of these broader benefits that would accrue to all Oregonians, promoting solar through the tax base would ensure that these benefits are shared by all Oregonians, that all Oregonians would have access to these solar programs rather than, I think, folks that are interested in participating in solar programs are not only the IOU's customers, but sometimes the sort of broader base of Oregonians, and all Oregonians would bear the cost of those particular programs. The second and third recommendations are focused on ratepayer-funded incentives that are really within the Oregon PUC's purview. And this recommendation, recommendation two, states that the PUC should align the solar net metering program so that the compensation method used is the same as the compensation method used for Oregon's community solar program under Senate Bill 1547. So Senate Bill 1547 created a community solar program, and it requires the electric company to credit owners or subscribers of a community solar project to be paid a rate that reflects the resource value of solar. And so, as I mentioned before, that's a metric that we are currently in the process of trying to figure out.
How do you contrast that with the PURPA value? Would it be the same? Are you talking about the avoided cost?
For the community, for the resource value of solar?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who's sponsoring?
You know, we haven't opened docket, so we haven't defined all the elements of the program or all the ways in which the resource value of solar is going to be calculated. So that is something that's in process now. But I will note that given the either 3 or 10 megawatt threshold for PURPA for calculating a standard avoided cost. You know, for any PURPA projects that are under that threshold, it's sort of an off-the-shelf rate that you take for that power. So it's a standard avoided cost rate. So for these projects, we're looking to get a little more granular so that we can determine, for example, a locational value or a configuration of a specific project, we may be able to get more granular. If I were to look at kind of what we're looking at right now for resource value of solar and what we've got in place right now for PURPA, I think I don't know how the values would shake out.
So I assume your starting point would be like your avoided cost. You're still using the value of a new gas plant as the base for setting your avoided cost rate.
Right, so the next deferrable resource.
That's sort of a base point. Mm-hmm. That's just sort of a pure energy cost forecast. And then there's some resource value, some reliability, some other values that you would stack on top of that. That would be the additional value that might be the solar. Same would apply to wind or any other resource.
Yes.
So you're adding up there. So it's sort of an energy-to-energy comparison.
I think that's right, and trying to get a handle on capacity value as well.
Yeah, that's a hard one, figuring out, you know, what's the value of a generator located in Salem versus one located in Baker.
Exactly.
To the PGE system.
I think that's right. But as you know, these decisions are getting more and more granular, and the ability to sort of look at locational values is increasing. And so we're sort of... we're looking at that right now in the ARVOS, how that might be possible.
So would you add into that if you had a plant, 5 megawatt, and they had a battery storage along with it, that would have other values that would attach to it as well then?
Right. I think intrinsically you would just have the ability to balance or smooth out that resource.
Some balancing and regulating values, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
I'm glad you're doing that job. Sorry to distract you.
No, not at all. So the question here is, we are developing the resource value of solar. As I noted, it's still in progress. It's a complex undertaking, as Chair Byer's questions illustrate. But the question will be when we sort of have that metric, and Senate Bill 1547 says that's what we should rely on to pay community solar subscribers or owners. The question is, should that also apply to net metering facilities? And so the idea we have here is that perhaps those should be aligned. And so when we finish determining the resource value of solar, we would then open a proceeding to see whether we should align that with sort of the net metering payments that we have on a going forward basis.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, given the fact that the federal government is bankrupt and the state is bankrupt, if all the subsidies for solar went away, how practical is solar as an energy source?
Chair Byer, Senator Girard, it's difficult to answer that question. I think, you know, if we go back and look at that chart, the federal tax credit incentive was one of 5 stacking incentives on there. I think it would just be speculation. What we'd see in the industry, you know, obviously there'd be a gap there that would either need to be filled by other incentives or greater motivation or cost continuing to decline. But, you know, when you stack those, you take one incentive out, I guess you'd say the out-of-pocket costs would be higher at this point in time.
Well, I will say, if you look across the country, not in the Northwest particularly, but there are a number of large traditional utilities that have shifted, that have found solar on a utility scale today in the right places is on par with gas. And yeah. Gas is cheaper than coal today. And nuclear is just out of sight long term because you can't get it permitted.
Yes, Chair Byer, Senator Girard, I was speaking, I guess, to the example of a residential customer with a rooftop solar PV program. There are different economics when you're talking about utility scale renewables, and the utilities are definitely investing in those at this time.
Well, it's because we pay a higher rate for them.
Anyway, we're distracting her again. I'll let the chairman,
a little more banter.
The chair, finish your presentation.
Well, you'll be pleased to know I'm at the last recommendation. So this recommendation has to do with the incentives that are provided by the Energy Trust of Oregon. As you know, these are funded through a public purpose charge that, among other that's collected from customers of PGE and PacifiCorp. And among other things, helps incentivize renewables. And this recommendation states that we should target Energy Trust of Oregon's solar electricity program to support applications that yield high-value benefits to the utility system or help bring down the soft costs of solar projects. That's definitely a mouthful. But the idea here is that we are trying to get a more granular view of the value of certain solar project versus others, for example, through the ARVOS proceeding. Right now, the Energy Trust determines above market cost by using the current net metering value, which is just, as you know, a retail rate. And if we are able to determine that in the future that certain solar PV installations are more valuable to the utility system as a whole than others, then the recommendation here would be for the Energy Trust to evaluate whether it makes sense to sort of pivot and target those high-value applications with the incentive money that they have. For efficiency purposes. And in terms of here the reference to soft costs of solar project, those are essentially non-equipment costs like labor costs, transaction costs. Those don't tend to go down as quickly as equipment costs. And so that's another area that the Energy Trust might target that we think would result in some efficiency, some in terms of using their incentives. So that is all I have. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this summary, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions? Guess not. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll move on to our final report then. It's on the drone industry. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Schwecker. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. And we have a little panel here while she's setting it up that includes some of the folks I think are very knowledgeable in the industry, and the economic development officer for Pendleton over here, Steve Christman. So just right off the bat, your panelists here, myself as a director, and then Brian Whiteside here, who is ex-president of the AUVSI Cascades chapter here, one of the most active chapters in the country. And then Steve Christman, who's the economic development officer and the airport manager for Pendleton. I would add that Steve just was able to get a new commercial air service to Pendleton to replace a bankrupt seaport. And boutique airline starts on, what, December 19th?
Correct. Yeah, very exciting.
And I just wanted to start off with kind of a basics here. This is how the FAA categorizes unmanned aircraft systems. They break it down into public use, which would be somebody like the Department of Aviation or Oregon State University or anybody like that, and then private use commercial, which is now in 2016 considered to be Part 107 under the FAA's regulations, and then private use recreational, which is probably the lion's share of the drone operators in the U.S.
Mitch, let me ask you a question about that. The private use, the commercial, would that include everything from a farmer using it to check his or her fields to somebody shooting a movie?
Chair Beyer, that's correct. Anything commercial, and I think Steve will talk a little bit more about the agricultural uses when he starts to talk a little bit too. But yes, movie making, taking photos of real estate, precision agriculture, anything that is essentially money changes hands.
So other than the military or Homeland Security, what would Where would we see that in public use?
Public use? You might see Oregon State has a very strong program, multiple uses, multiple platforms that they use for research and development and academic purposes. Forestry has used them.
Okay, that makes sense.
Fish and wildlife. So the three federally designated weight classes here, by FAA standards, anything over 55 pounds, heavy under 55 pounds, which under Part 107, all under that. And then I've got 4.4 pounds here, but they've actually revised that downward to be 0.55, just a little over half of a pound, to be a micro size. And then there's really three main issues when you talk about drones, and that's you can pretty much dump them all into these three slots: privacy, law enforcement concerns, and then safety. You've all seen the concerns about drones flying too close to commercial aircraft flying in and out of airports. And then these changes here, it's a kind of a busy slide, but this is all things that have happened in the past year. Since 2012, when Congress directed the FAA to really engage and allow unmanned aircraft systems into the national airspace, they move kind of slow and cautiously for the first couple of years, but this last year, kind of a flurry of activity. Including requiring registration of all recreational ones right before Christmas last year out of an abundance of concern that there would be a lot of them set loose into the atmosphere here. And then they also used a what they called Aviation Rulemaking Committee, an ARC, to provide input from the public and give themselves what I would call top cover. After proceeding so slowly, this recommendation committee, this rulemaking committee, helped to guide them in how they did the recreational
registration. Is the requirement for all recreational ones to be registered?
It is.
So how do you do that when you're walking through the toy store?
They very quickly set up a website, and the fee is nominal. They charge $5, and they required at first all recreational ones, and that was fairly successful. They've got now well over 300,000 registrations, more than they have manned aircraft in the FAA registration.
I don't database. See how that's even feasible to do it. I mean, literally, just you pull out Sunday's ads, and I just happened to be looking at that, and almost every store was selling one version or another from the two that I just bought for my young grandchildren that I suspect won't go very high, to the other ones that look like you put have a GoPro on them and you could easily have them up 100 feet. My guess is those will not be registered.
They may not be, but by FAA regulation, they are in fact required to be and to be marked so that you can identify them and have some sort of accountability. So anything recreational, and they, in fact, if you look down a little bit further, they've actually expanded that to require both commercial and public use to be registered as well. So now it's a blanket
registration. That one makes more sense. So now I want to be real clear. The state doesn't have any responsibility for that, does it?
Actually, under House Bill 2710 from 2013, the legislature required us to register the public use ones that are used here in Oregon. So
okay,
we have
that's
a registration
not a problem.
Database that includes the Oregon states and some of the other agencies that are, in fact, using them. Not recreational and not commercial.
Good.
So just going on down here, all these things happened kind of bang, bang, bang. In the federal regulation, they drafted the rulemaking for unmanned aircraft systems that are less than 0.55 pounds based on the kinetic energy of whether it could hurt you if it would hit you or not. And so the FAA intends to expand the use and allowance of them over crowds, for example, based on their potential to hurt you if it fell and hit you. And then FAA Part 107 became effective on August 29th of 2016, and that's a much less restrictive requirement for commercial operators. Before, it was a case-by-case exception, what they called an exception to the 2012 FAA Modernization Reauthorization Act, which basically Section 333 dealt with drones, and there was a blanket prohibition, but they allowed case-by-case exceptions, and they accelerated up until the time that they put Part 107 into place. So, in Oregon, back in 2013, the legislature passed House Bill 2710, which was actually a fairly comprehensive law, and along with Alaska and North Carolina, was one of the most comprehensive that was passed around the country. And then changed it again in 2015 because one of the restrictions under the 2000 or House Bill 2710, the FAA had for recreational use unmanned aircraft systems, you couldn't fly any higher than 400 feet. And then in our state law, we said over private property, you couldn't fly any lower than 400 feet. So we're kind of directly in contravention to that. So 2015, that was corrected. Some nomenclature changes and the intent of the operator, vice the altitude, became the thing. And then we also, legislature put a no angling or hunting with unmanned aircraft systems in 2015. And then in 2016, clarified privacy due process, expanded no weaponization from only applying to law enforcement to now also applying to everybody. Nobody could weaponize that. And then put a critical protection or critical infrastructure protection clause in there, too. So some things like chemical plants and refineries are protected under the state law below 400 feet from any incursions. And then there's a stakeholders work group that's been in place since 2013. And that's been led by State Representative John Huffman, includes a lot of stakeholders from industry, law enforcement, ACLU, some state agencies, and judiciary attorney Channa Newell has helped organize those as well. And then there are four legislative concepts for this session coming up. I don't have the language on those because I think they're still in work, but they're going to deal with some of those issues that I talked about, law enforcement, privacy, safety, and commercial use, and specifically I think one of them deals with agriculture.
Are they coming out of the work group? Is that where the concepts?
They've been vetted with the work group, but they've, I think, come out of judiciary, and I'm not quite sure where all four of the concepts are coming from. And then the last thing I have before I turn it over to my colleagues is the FAA put out a memo last December, which was kind of a shot across the bow for the states and how they regulate. And I put some of the language from that in there. First paragraph there is federal preemption. The Congress and the FAA reserve airspace as their exclusive right to regulate that. And then you can see in the red ink there, substantial air safety issues are raised when state and local governments attempt to regulate the operation of aircraft. They don't want to create the patchwork quilt of different regulations so that you don't know, flying from one jurisdiction to another, how that would work. And then under 2710, the state also put in a preemption law that says that only the legislature has the right to regulate unmanned aircraft systems in the state, that it can't be done below the state legislature level. And I'll turn that over to my colleagues, subject to any questions.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Brian Whiteside. I am a board member of the Oregon State Board of Aviation. I am the COO and co-founder of a company called Complier Enterprise, and I am the founder of a company called VDOS Global based in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm coming here today really to speak to you a little bit about the state of the industry, where technology is going, and where it's been. And before I go, first, we're very fortunate here in Oregon. Mitch has been doing a really good job in representing sort of, I think, the state aviation requirements, leading into building this coalition of people dealing with very complicated regulations. So it's great to see Oregon. I serve on numerous committees nationally. I'm part of a rulemaking committee on defining the standards for well clear, how to integrate UAVs into the national airspace and deal with manned and unmanned aviation. I serve on the helicopter safety advisory committee, mostly focused on the Gulf of Mexico and how to deal with safety and flight operations around the Gulf. And then I'm also a member of the Helicopter Association International UAS committee, working on trying to develop, again, more best practices and recommendations for the HII working groups that represent international operations. The slide that I've got up there, actually, if you go back, you know, the question was about what are people doing commercially with drones. These are actually some images from the work that we do with under VDOS, and it gives you an example of sort of the kinds of what you can do commercially with the technology. On the left, you've got that's a bowhead whale from work that we did up in the Arctic this past summer, doing research on whales up in the Arctic environment. You can see a cell phone tower inspection that's here in Oregon, windmill inspections on a windmill turbine that had caught on fire, and then on the far right there, some offshore inspections on flare stacks and offshore production platforms. Those are great examples of why drones are so valuable. There's a real need for this technology, and it's not necessarily what you imagine people doing with drones. So what are we doing here in Oregon? What's unique about Oregon is we really are a cluster in the industry. A lot of this came up with the sort of the founding of In Situ and the growth in the Hood River and the Gorge tech area. But across the state, we have a tremendous groundswell, whether it's because of the test ranges, the universities, the tech companies that are coming to Oregon. But if you look at who's here in Oregon, this is really a unique area in the world. There's a lot of overflow coming out of Silicon Valley. So we're seeing companies like Amazon and Google, other companies that are getting into the unmanned vehicle market. And I bring up the ground vehicle market because if you look at the future, the technology is going cross domains. So the car of the future may not necessarily just drive, or it may not be a boat, but we're going to see stuff that swims and goes in the water and also flies. So our future with this technology is really blending. And by future, I'm talking 2025 and beyond. So this isn't tomorrow. But this is where we're going. And the world that we're really trying to understand and figure out right now is how do we incorporate and bring this technology forward. But here in Oregon, we have a tremendous area of clustered companies that are really pioneering this industry, more so than I think people realize. If you look at the future, what this market really represents, you know, Mitch brought it up. The Part 107 rules are really the first step at a commercial application environment for the community. That's only 4 months old. So we're going with a community that is basically 4 months in its birth or its existence to where we're going to be in 2020, according to Goldman Sachs, of a $20 billion a year industry. That's a lot of growth in just about 3 years. So there's tremendous value and jobs and resources that are being poured into this industry. Oregon sits at the forefront of this, but we need to appreciate really what this means from an economic impact and where things are going. And I think there's a huge disconnect. People assume that we've been doing drones for a long time. Well, it's really only 4 months old. And that's the key take-home message, is that we're just starting as an industry. What are the trends? Well, right now we kind of live in this world of disconnected silos. So if you think about where technology is going, right now it lives in separate entities and separate components. In the next couple of years, what we're going to see is that the maturity of the industry is going to happen. We're going to see the companies start to integrate and blend the necessary requirements, whether they're from legal issues or technology or safety issues. That's sort of the next step, is as the industry matures, and then by about 2020, we'll really start to see the full expansion of what this market means and where technology is really going to go. But we have to understand that this is an evolution, that the technology that we think of today has a long ways to go. But we have to understand that if we don't build an infrastructure or support it here, it's going to happen elsewhere. So we need to appreciate it. That's not mean that it needs to be necessarily given special incentives or gifts. But I think we need to build an environment that understands where we're going and can allow it to occur and to continue to grow and blossom here in the state. That's really, really important.
Good morning, Chair. Committee members. My name is Steve Crispin. I'm the airport manager and economic development director out in Pendleton, Oregon. I moved out there 4 years ago from the Oregon coast. Quite a climate change. I arrived in town, and the city manager and the mayor, Mayor Hauck, said we want high-tech and advanced manufacturing jobs. We'd like to keep our youth from bleeding out to the cities to get jobs. We want to stop brain drain. What can we do? And so I took an assessment of what assets we had, one of which was an enormous World War II era airport that trained Doolittle's Raiders, had a lot of great history, but was averaging about 10 to 20 operations a day. So that was an asset, but wasn't going to become a commercial hub anymore. Folks in the state, two of which are sitting here at the table, were in an effort to attract one of these test sites. And in the test site designation, I saw an opportunity to have a unique competitive advantage that would help attract high-tech and advanced manufacturing into a place where it wouldn't normally site. And so we threw our hat in the ring. It's been a long process. I think it's aged all of us, but there's some exciting things starting to happen that are very, very rare in my experience in rural Oregon. So we have the only three FAA-approved test ranges on the contiguous West Coast: Warm Springs, Tillamook, and Pendleton. Those are great advantages to have, and this stuff requires rural America. It can't be done at PDX. It can't be done at SeaTac. It has to be done in a rural place where there's low population, low ground cover. Clients, we're dealing with folks from, you know, all over the world at this point. That right now we have SOAR Oregon funded a project called the Future Farm in Pendleton, which is a company called Digital Harvest was the mastermind behind this. It is integrating the data, the various data layers from satellites to drone-based sensors to ground-based vehicle sensors to irrigation pivots to ground soil sensors, and feeding the farmer real-time actionable information. So it's really cutting-edge, state-of-the-art technology, and that project was done. It's now rolled off and created a new ground-based robotics program that's being conducted. Those folks have a satellite office, Digital Harvest. A Virginia company has a satellite office in the Pendleton Terminal, which was empty for many years prior to that. Because of their relationships with Yamaha Motor Corporation, they've now come in and leased space at the Pendleton Airport. So they're doing a different project, but they're there because of the activity that's occurred and the SOAR Oregon funding. So beyond that, we've had no less than, we're in discussions, various states of discussion, with no less than six Fortune 500 companies, most of them Fortune 100 companies, that reached out to us based on press they had seen. That's exciting. For rural Oregon, I know of, other than data centers, I don't know of a lot of instances where you could expect that kind of stuff to be happening. So it's Future Farms attracting companies from Europe. We couldn't be more thrilled. This thing has been slow to develop. It's been painful. It's, as I said, it's aged all of us, but we probably did less than a half a dozen operations in 2015. We did 118 in 2016. So those were from numerous different companies, from California to Washington to Virginia. So we're thrilled. It's not been easy, but we've turned the corner in my belief, and expected operations for rural Oregon. Our range covers the entire northeastern corner of Oregon. So we've already conducted operations in three different towns. We expect it to cover the northwest region. The way that looks is flight test teams of 5 to 20 people will come in and site in hotels and stay for anywhere from a couple days to a couple weeks to a couple months and conduct their operations. And so it's had an economic impact. Will that turn into jobs? We believe it will, but the first objective has to be getting them into Oregon, getting them flying and getting to like the airspace, which we think we have some really special assets in Oregon, and want to see you continue to support it.
So is this the companies that are working with you, are they just coming in to test, and are they doing their development and manufacturing elsewhere?
It depends, but at present, most of them are doing their developing elsewhere. So they're coming in. Historically, there really was no commercial path to there was no pathway to commercialization for a UAS manufacturer. So historically, they've done their testing in military test ranges, extremely expensive. You can get bumped out of there pretty easily if another project comes up that's related to government activity. So we're offering them a solution for that. And the folks we see coming in are doing R&D for technology that they want to commercialize. They're training crews. Pacific Northwest National Laboratories has been flying at the range for over a year. They just acquired a 22-foot wingspan aircraft and will be flying again in February. So they bring their crews down. They do their global climate change testing on the North Slope of Alaska, but they're actually coming to Pendleton to train their crews because it's inhospitable, it's expensive to get there. So there's a couple different activities we see occurring: crew training, customer training, and then R&D. Go ahead. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'd also point out that we have Arlen Squire, who's the Warm Springs test director in the gallery back here, and also Earl Bowerman, who's the executive director for SOAR. We're also very involved in the industry development. And we're here to answer any questions.
Questions?
Very interesting.
Huh?
It's just the technology and how fast things are moving. It's pretty impressive.
Well, there's some real advantages to a lot of it. It looks like speak as well.
Thank you. Aaron Squire, I am the range manager.
Could you let her speak? Set there so she has a mic, please. We need to get you on the record.
Good morning. My name is Aaron Dwyer. I'm the range manager at Warm Springs Unmanned Aerial Systems. We have four launch sites, and we had our first flight in February of this year, and worked very closely with VDOS Global, with our clients. And we are on NASA's radar because Central Oregon is got the longest viewing of the solar eclipse 2017. So we're on the phone with them about every other week. We're the only location in the country that in which the solar eclipse crosses a mountain. And so we've been had reservations at Kaneda for 3 years. Japan rented the entire resort 3 years ago.
Wow.
So Central Oregon is going to be very busy. We have such clients as a world-class laboratory on assignment from the White House that has been flying in Nevada. And they're very bitter about the services there. For one thing, it's a military base, and it's an hour and a half to any type of services, whether it's meals or lodging, and the driving there alone, an hour and a half, set up and do the R&D. And so we are in the competition for that, along with four other test ranges. Most of the test ranges infrastructure are vastly built out. North Dakota just invested $34 million, and we're fortunate that the state infrastructure provided $500,000 grant plus $500,000 forgivable loan, and we're benefiting because the cost of infrastructure today is much less than in the past, and so we're playing catch-up with the industry. We have a transmission line, de-energized line, Bonneville Power, never used on the reservation, 20 miles of de-energized transmission line. We've partnered up with a company in Portland that has a rigging system for safety of linemen. 690 linemen die from the transmission line, 120-foot high transmission line. We devised a system that is patented with the rigging system. The drone takes the line over the transmission line, anchors it for the safe transportation of the linemen hands-free for inspections. And the drone, we will be manufacturing the drone in February at Warm Springs. And we're talking to the big boys. The East Coast is far ahead of us as far as the drone industry goes for the transmission lines. We're finding out Exelon purchased a number of drones from our partner, and they have 100,000 linemen, and so we're looking at this growth to be very, very important to Kaneda Vacation Resort, to creating jobs. We just closed our sawmill at Warm Springs, so it's real critical for us to come here and voice our concern about continuous support from the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
I have one. There was a lot of talk about how this is a testing facility and how obviously we want to see if we could get some manufacturing jobs. Is there anything that we could do to promote that as a state so that we could land more of those type of jobs?
I think what we've done by creating and marketing three excellent test ranges for folks to come and test is absolutely the first step in making that happen. There's various, I mean, you can be involved in the engineering, the part manufacturing, the assembly, and any one or all of those could end up in Oregon. Companies, it's, you know, from my experience, and I don't have a lot of experience in aerospace, are oftentimes, and maybe Brian knows more, going to want to keep some or all of that
fairly close to where they're doing some of the flying.
I would say probably one of the biggest things to not do is create legislation that would be detrimental to, or creating bureaucracy that would impact sort of the ecosystem that's just growing. So anything that we can do just to let the ecosystem kind of develop and keep on track, I think that's going to be the best that you could do. We've got a great team here that's sort of fostering that environment. The state is being recognized nationally and internationally. So what we don't want to do is sort of put something in place that's going to change that roadmap that we're on. That would be really just, honestly, just let it kind of foster and continue to grow. I think we're in a really good spot.
To tag on to what Orlin said, New York just put $30 million into creating a 50-mile flight test corridor for this very purpose, for their test site. So there are a lot of folks throwing a lot of money at this, a lot of other states involved in this. We're very fortunate in Oregon. We don't have a lot of population, so we sort of have pre-existing empty corridors. So it would be, to tag on to what Brian just said, a monumental mistake from my perspective to put up any roadblocks. Oregon is very well positioned, and we need to continue to push forward with this.
Very compatible with those large wheat fields over there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeez. I guess I'm curious. My opinion has always been on this for the last few years that we shouldn't interfere with the FAA, which has the predominant role here. Is there a role for state legislation within that? I've always been concerned about that.
The Chair Beyer, members of the committee. The stakeholder group has been tackling that, especially as it regards to the interaction between the FAA and airspace over issues like privacy, where somebody flies over somebody's backyard and the perceptions they're looking at the end of the hot tub or whatever the case may be. And trying to find that definition is a little bit tough. The FAA has exercised their preemption authorization via that memo from December of last year, but they're not really in a position to pursue it, and so I think the danger of preemption is probably not there anytime soon. They're struggling with their own bandwidth to be able to implement the legislation that they've passed and the regulation that they're responsible for enforcing. So there's interaction, and we work with the Flight Standards District Office here in Oregon and at the national level. I know Brian does, and so there is interaction between the two, but.
Yeah, there's always a knee-jerk reaction to try and get in to deal with some of that, which I've been reluctant to do.
Yes. Chairman, one of the benefits of the drones are utilized for firefighting as a tool, and at Warm Springs, being a sovereign nation, we have the capacity to do a large controlled burn. We held one in May, burning 4,500 acres, and the drones have the capacity to make a map. They can drop the aerial ignition to start the fire. They can monitor the fire at nighttime or through the smoke. They can deliver supplies. Yeah. And so we're working with our neighbors, the Yakima Nation, which has a large land base, Colville and Umatilla, Nez Perce, and doing rotating training to become a center of excellence for wildland firefighting.
Lots of uses. Anything else, team? Thank you very much. Good luck with all of those. It's a really great opportunity. All righty. Patrick, I think we're down to bill introduction.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All righty. Colleagues, as normal on this kind, we have opened the floodgates for anybody who wanted to introduce a bill. And again, on the record, to be clear with people, is I don't even know what's in a lot of these, but we're just introducing them. Introducing the bill is in no way a commitment to support it once the session starts. It's just to get it into the process. So having said that, I would move that we...
Don't we need a work session open first?
Just go ahead and gavel.
Oh, got an opening.
Open a work session.
I'm sorry. I'm just out of practice.
Me too.
We'll open thank you very much, Senator. We'll open a work session for the purpose of bill introduction.
Yeah.
And the chair would move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 407, dated 12, 2nd, 16. LC 1240, dated 12-6-16, LC 1272, dated 11-3-16, LC 1488, dated 9-29-16, LC 1562, dated 12-6-16, LC 1563, dated 12-6-16, LC 1688, dated 10-14-16, LC 1751, dated 11-30-16, LC 1815, dated 11-3-16, LC 1851, dated 11-28-16, LC 1943, dated 10-17-16, LC 2635, dated 10-7-16, and LC 3239, dated 12-6-16. We did get yours in there, right?
Yes, you did.
You got them. That's the motion. Is there a discussion on the motion?
I think we should do all of them but the first one.
Is there any further discussion on the motion? Yes. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, the motion passes unanimously, and the bills are introduced, and we'll end that. And is there anything else, Patrick, for the good of the order?
Sure, I think that's everything.
That's everything.
For
all right.
Session for this legislature.
And again, members, if there's stuff that you want introduced when we get into session now, we'll do that as committee bills as well. Some like to do that instead of having their name on it.
Jason, I don't know why that's true.
We're adjourned, huh?
How could it be
you're adjourned, huh?
How could it be?